This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today, we're bringing you the story of a large, close-knit family ripped apart by a barrage of bullets in a senseless double homicide. A story of a devoted mother and father shot in the dark.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Our story begins on the evening of Monday, May 10th, 1993, near Canastota, New York, at the six-acre rural homestead of 76-year-old Carl Stab and his wife, 66-year-old Jessie. They just spent the weekend celebrating Mother's Day with their kids and grandkids. The weather was unseasonably warm, and that evening they spent time on the porch visiting with their adult son, Tom, who'd moved back home to live with them due to a separation from his wife. Another son, Joe, stops by to say hello. They visit for a bit, and eventually Tom and Joe leave the house separately. But since 36-year-old Tom was living there, he was expected to return later. Carl and Jesse's evening routine would be to sit together in the living room after dinner. They each had their own recliner where they'd relax and watch TV before going to bed. Here's their youngest son, Terry.
My parents, I mean, that's what they did every evening, was watch TV. So it was pretty typical of them to be there.
Tom returns home around 10:30 p.m. and enters the house through the side door into the kitchen. He calls out to his parents, but gets no response. When he steps into the living room, he makes a horrific discovery. Both his mother and father are dead in their recliners, covered in blood. What happened? And that is the question that's still challenging police investigators more than 30 years later. So, who are the Stabs, and why would anyone want to kill them? Carl, who sometimes called Leonard by his friends, had met and married his wife Jessie when they were just teenagers. As the story goes, he was actually interested in dating Jessie's younger sister, but her father wouldn't allow it. So he asked Jessie out instead. And in 1993, their 50th wedding anniversary was just months away. They'd raised up all 10 of their kids in their home on South Court Street. Here's Terry.
My dad was strict. He worked a lot. He had a strong work ethic, and he instilled it in us.
Terry said they didn't have a lot of money, but they always had clean clothes and food to eat, and his dad worked multiple jobs to support his family. So by 1993, all 10 of the Stab kids were grown and had moved out. But as we mentioned, one son had moved back in.
But everyone was out of the house. I know my brother, Tom, had been staying with them, had been living at the house for a short time.
So let's talk about the events leading up to the murders. By all accounts, it had been a normal weekend, especially Sunday. Sundays at the Stabs are about family and food. And according to son Terry, his mom Jessie was a great cook, and her Sunday dinners weren't to be missed.
Typically, Sundays, my mom would cook a big meal. When I was growing up, you look forward to Sunday afternoons. Everyone would come and have dinner as a family. I had quite a few nephews and nieces. We look forward to Sundays.
And as the kids grew up and started their own families, those traditions continued with the Stab grandchildren.
Yeah, at the time they passed, they probably had somewhere between 25 and 30 grandchildren. And most of them would be there on Sundays, be running around the barn or chasing after chickens or animals. Because my dad liked to have animals. There was always something to do, hiking, fishing. So the grandkids were always around.
This particular Sunday was Mother's Day. So whoever was in town, children or grandchildren, they'd be at the house to celebrate. And any family who lived out of town would be calling to wish Jessie a happy Mother's Day. The mood was celebratory, and everyone had a good time. Here's youngest daughter, Veronica.
We all came up, gave presents to her, had dinner. The ones that usually goes up there, usually was me, Pat, and Joni. Tommy lived there at the time.
Pat and Joni are two of Veronica's sisters. Monday, the day of the murders, started out like any other day for the family. Everyone in the household had their own routine. Carl had chores to do.
Got up, ate breakfast, went outside, fed the animals, came back in, laid on the couch and took a nap. My mom got up, fixed breakfast, fixed lunch, fixed dinner, other than and watched the soap operas.
According to Veronica, she dropped her 10-month-old son off at the house that Monday morning on her way to work. Her parents love spending time with their grandkids, so they didn't mind babysitting. And in fact, Veronica's baby son was going to stay overnight. Veronica told us that her brother, Tom, had his own construction-type business at the time, but she wasn't sure exactly what he did that day. She said that sometime during the day, she changed her mind about letting her son stay the night, so she picked him up on her way home. We spoke with New York State Police Investigator Timothy Doherty, who has the case today. We asked him about the circumstances that Monday evening.
Tom and his brother Joe had both been at the home earlier in the evening with their parents. As well, we know that the two of them had been outside in the yard or at the front steps of the house having conversation throughout the evening with their parents. Tom's believed to have left the home at around 7:30 p.m. and it's believed that his brother Joe left about an hour or so later.
Police said that independent witnesses see the Stabs in front of the house that evening talking with each other, and everything appears fine. Joe leaves between 8 and 8:30 p.m. That's the last time Carl and Jesse are seen alive. Investigator Doherty.
So Tom explained that he'd been out and about that evening, that when he returned to the residence, he could see lights flickering from outside indicating that television was on. There was also lights on inside the home indicating that his parents were still awake. He advised that typically speaking, his father would go to bed a little earlier, and he was a bit surprised that he would have still been up at this hour, but it was not unusual for his mother to still be awake. Said that he saw nothing suspicious outside the residence as he approached the home.
Tom said he didn't see anything out of the ordinary until he enters the living room. It's 10:24 p.m. on Monday, May 10, 1993, when state police get a call from Tom Stabb. Again, Investigator Doherty.
He indicated that he had just returned home that evening and found his parents in living room recliners covered in blood and unresponsive.
When the call comes in, EMS, along with the state police and the Madison County Sheriff's Office, begin responding. An off-duty member of the Sheriff's Department who lived a short distance away from the Stabs hears the radio call and he also responds.
As he arrived, there was also members of EMS were already on the scene. He approached the home, entered the residence, and was able to find the two, Carl and Jesse Stabb, who were both visibly deceased from apparent gunshot wounds, again, in their living room recliners. At that point, the only other person at the residence was the individual that had called to report it, their 36-year-old son, Tom Stabb.
One of the first things police notice is a break in the glass of the living room window.
On further examination of that window, it became apparent that the gunshots had been fired from right outside this window. Their shell casings were discovered outside the home, outside this window, in close proximity to the home itself, which indicated the shooter was standing right outside the home, right outside this living room window, where he was able to see the two victims.
Terry Stabb described the window. It's not the picture window located on the front of the house, but a smaller window on the side. You can see a layout in our show notes.
And that window would have been in that corner on that side of the living room.
We asked state police if the shooter would have been able to see the victims from outside that window.
He would have, yes. He or she would have.
Here's the Stabb's daughter, Veronica.
The side door that we used, before you get to the door, there was a window right there, and it went to the living room. That's the window they were shot through. My mom sat on one side, like straight across from that window, and my dad sat on the other side going into the dining room.
Here's Terry.
To me, it's odd only because there was a big picture window that looked into the living room from the front porch. It's just weird to me that somebody would go to the side of the house and shoot through that window, but that's what happened.
Police did tell us that both subjects had been shot in the head more than once and there were no other significant wounds. The cause of death was gunshot wounds to the head. But police aren't releasing the type of gun or the caliber involved. Why would somebody shoot these two people? And what weapon did they use?
During interviews with the Stab family, multiple people relayed information that there had been a rifle that Carl Stab kept in his barn, as well as other weapons in the home. All the other weapons in the home were accounted for. However, this rifle that was kept in the barn was never located. You can say that was also a small caliber weapon, but we don't know exactly when the last time that weapon would have been in the barn or the last time it would have been accounted for.
We asked Terry about that rifle.
My dad did at one time keep a loaded gun in the barn, and that was just if something was attacking the chickens or something like that, it was there. I know he took it when he was hunting or trapping. He would take it with him. But otherwise, he kept it in the barn.
And where exactly was the rifle kept in the barn?
There was a barrel in the barn that my dad would keep feed for the chickens and the pigeons and whatever. And then there was a lid that he kept on top of it to keep animals out of it. And in that barrel is where he would keep the gun. So it wasn't out. If you walked through or into the barn, you would not have seen it. Somebody in the family would be the only people who knew about the gun being there. It wasn't like out in the open. So, I mean, you'd have to know where he kept it.
I asked Investigator Doherty if he thought the shooter had any marksmanship training, having shot Mr. and Mrs. Stab from outside the living room window.
I don't think that you could really make that determination. I think that would just be speculative. From where the shooter would have been standing, it would have been in rather close proximity to the victims, so it certainly wouldn't necessarily indicate any sort of expert marksmanship.
I keep coming back to the location of that window. I asked Terry how he thought someone would approach the house.
I would think somebody would come from the barn side of the property to get to that window and not be seen. Coming from the front of the house, you would almost have to be seen. You'd be walking past multiple windows to get to that window. Somebody would probably have to come up from the barn because you're not walking past all those windows to get to the window that was used.
The Stab property is located in somewhat of a rural area, but there are other homes not too far away. Could they be within hearing distance of the gunfire? As part of their investigation, police interview neighbors to determine if they saw or heard anything out of the ordinary.
Several people reported potentially hearing gunshots at different portions during the day. The state police did reenact the crime itself, firing small caliber weapon that was consistent with that was used in the crime, to see if the neighbors that believed they'd heard something would in fact hear those rounds being fired, and it appeared that they would not. So we don't believe that we have anybody that heard the specific time that those shots were fired. Certainly a very thorough neighborhood canvas conducted that would have included, you know, any suspicious persons or vehicles that were observed in the area that evening. And people did report seeing individuals and vehicles that caught their attention, all of which has been examined thoroughly, really with differing degrees of validity. Really able to corroborate those claims is been difficult to do.
Investigator Doherty told me that during the joint investigation with the Madison County Sheriff's Office, a number of resources were used.
Over the course of the investigation, aviation would be used, as would the dive team that would end up searching ponds and nearby creek, attempting to locate possible murder weapon.
As we said, the house and the barn sat on 6 acres. How did the killer approach and then flee from the house? Could it have been from behind the house in order not to be seen? We asked Terry what was back there.
So there was actually two pastures behind the house. It would be a track to walk from behind, from the back. There were multiple fields, and there was a creek back there that you'd have to cross to come from behind.
Authorities conducted a thorough canvas of the whole area. They interviewed neighbors, friends, and family members. I asked Investigator Doherty if any evidence was found during their searches. He said they do have evidence in the case, but could not specifically talk about it. So let's explore possible motives for killing two defenseless people. Is robbery the motive? There's the rifle that may be missing from the barn, and Carl Stabb's wallet also seems to be missing.
That's correct. Carl Stabb's wallet was never located and never accounted for. Having said that, he did have a rather significant amount of cash on his person that was not taken. So can't definitively say if that wallet potentially a motive or if that is unrelated and for whatever reason just never located.
Here's Terry.
Honestly, have never seen my dad with a wallet. I mean, he's always had cash in his pocket, but never, I don't believe I ever saw him with a wallet, but he may have had one.
When we spoke with Veronica, she has a memory of her dad having a wallet. So Carl's wallet may or may not be missing. But what's strange is the money. There's cash, and lots of it. And it's all over the house. And a significant amount is still in Carl's pocket. Police aren't saying how much. Here's Terry.
My dad had a lot of cash around the house because he bought and furs and stuff, trappers would come, and it was a cash business. That doesn't surprise me.
Here's Veronica.
The money was in his shirt pocket. All my mom's money was still in her pocketbook. My mom and dad didn't trust banks. She had a bag of money stuffed between the mattresses, a shoebox full of money, and the cellar door. And no money was taken from that.
And it's unknown if the shooter entered the home after the murder.
Mentioned before, no sign of a forced entry. The home was not ransacked. Nothing appeared out of the ordinary in the home itself. And nor did the bodies of the victims appear to have been tampered with in any way.
Why did they shoot the victims and then leave? Were they planning on robbing them and then got scared off?
Really, any theory would be speculation as well. We do know that Carl and Jesse Stabb, they did have money. That certainly has come up as a potential motive. But again, the fact that Carl had money on his person doesn't appear that much was taken. It really would be a speculation to make any guesses regarding the motive.
So if we do speculate about another financial motivation, let's talk about life insurance and property value. Whatever those assets were, with both parents dead, between the cash and the property, Carl and Jesse's estate would have probably been divided among the 10 children. So is there really a financial motive here?
There wasn't a lot, I think, but at the end, with selling the house, I mean, I believe that we ended up each getting around $10,000. So there wasn't much of anything.
We asked Investigator Doherty if there had been any prior calls to police at the Stabb residence.
Nothing indicating any kind of disputes or arguments or violence at the home. There had been two previous burglaries reported at the home a year or so prior to this incident, in which items and money had been stolen from the home.
Those previous burglaries were in July 1992 and the last one in March 1993. A few months before the murders. Those thieves were never caught. Did they come back for more? That theory's interesting, but it doesn't make sense since nothing else was taken from the home. Was the motive something more personal? There's been some speculation that a family member had something to do with it. Joe and Tom Stabb were the last two to see their parents alive. Here's Terry.
I've talked to them about what happened. I don't believe that any of them are lying to me. I have heard that some people suspect my brother Tom. I don't know why he would have done it. I haven't specifically asked him if he had done it, but I don't believe he did it.
Veronica told us that her brother Tom was not at the family dinner on Mother's Day, but would have shown up later. Veronica said that she herself and others who were there on Mother's Day all took polygraph tests and gave DNA samples, except for Tom. Veronica has heard that Tom is a suspect.
I can't. I haven't talked to Tommy in years. I know he done other stuff, so I can't be positive, but he could have done that.
Veronica told us that her brother Tom had been accused of threatening the mayor of the nearby city of Oneida. According to a report in the Syracuse Post-Standard from 1987, 6 years before the murders, Tom Stabb was accused of attempting to extort $100,000 from the city through a couple of threatening letters and a phone call to the mayor. It was alleged that Tom Stabb threatened to kill the mayor's family and firefighters if his demand was not met. Those same reports indicate that an FBI handwriting expert testified at Stabb's trial, saying that Tom Stabb's handwriting matched one letter exactly and had similar characteristics to the other. And the threatening phone call to the mayor was traced to the residence of Carl and Jesse Stabb, where Tom Stabb was reportedly working outside on his wife's car. But after a trial in 1988, Tom Stabb was acquitted of the charges against him. So, back to the murders of Carl and Jesse Stabb. We asked about alibis for the last people reported to see them alive, their two sons, Tom and Joe.
Standard course of our investigation would be to alibi out those individuals as well as everybody else's whose names came up. And those alibis had differing levels of success. Some are very well alibied out and some not so much.
The murders of Carl and Jesse Stabb have had a profound impact on the family. Here's Terry.
My parents were the focal point. We don't do the big Sunday dinner. People don't get together. But that center point of my parents just isn't there anymore.
Some of the siblings have passed away, and the rest are left with unanswered questions. I asked Terry what he'd like to say to the person responsible for killing his parents.
You know, it's been 31 years. I have prayed about it. I am at the point where I have forgiven whoever did it. I wish that they would just come forward and take responsibility. And it would just ease everybody's mind knowing what happened. So I wish they would come forward.
Terry told us about his thoughts on the investigation.
As far as the police go, I think they're doing the best they can. You know, it's been 31 years, so at this point, it's a cold case. And unless somebody admits to it, I don't see them being able to close the case. And I don't hold it against them. I just don't think there was a lot of evidence for them to be able to make an arrest or get a conviction. So I know they're doing the best that they can, and I'm sure they look at the case when they can, as often as they can.
Police are still looking for answers, hoping that someone will come forward with that one piece of information, maybe an overheard conversation, some clue that will bring an answer. If you have any information on the murders of Carl and Jesse Stabb, call the New York State Police Major Crimes Unit at 315-366-6000. For show notes, including pictures, map, timeline, and blog, visit apbcoldcase.com.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.